professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. This is the second hour of the program, and in this hour, we'll be looking at what seems to be a very American kind of phenomenon, something that goes back some way in this country, in fact, further back perhaps than we might suspect. If you walk into just about any bookstore in the United States, you will find a large section of self-help books. These books are extremely popular and have been now going back at least a few decades. Now, you might think that interest in these books, the existence of these books, it's a kind of a recent phenomenon. But in fact, it seems that this kind of book has been part of American life really for a long time. And this morning, in this part of the show, we'll try to ask some questions about what is the appeal of the self-help book. And our guest is Sandra Dolby. She is professor of folklore and American studies at Indiana University. And she's authored a book that asks the question, self-help books, why Americans keep reading them. She, in fact, in the process of doing this book, herself read a couple of 100 of these books and asks in the book and in her book and tries to answer some basic questions about whether, in fact, this is new or not, or it represents a kind of a literary tradition, popular literary tradition that goes back some way in the United States, how it is you account for the success of these books, and particularly what these books tell us about the popular wisdom of mainstream Americans. And we will talk about those very questions here this morning in this part of the show. And, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions, comments. The book, Self-Help Books, Why Americans Keep Reading Them, is published by the University of Illinois Press and should be available in a bookstore near you if you'd like to take a look at it. Questions are also welcome here on the program, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So, again, here locally in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people want to join the conversation, they can certainly do that. Professor Dolby, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
I appreciate being able to talk with you. It's nice.
Two things, I guess. Well, the first thing, obviously, that caught my attention when I picked up the book was that I thought that the very question the title poses is an interesting one. Why it is Americans are interested in this kind of book. So that, right, you got me right away, right from the very cover of the book. And then I think also something that interested me was your particular academic expertise, the fact that you're a folklorist. And I think that I would not have been surprised that someone who was a psychologist or a sociologist or anthropologist or possibly a historian would be interested in this very question. But that caught my attention, the fact that you were a folklorist, and that would mean that you would approach this in a certain kind of way that perhaps some of these other folks would not. And that interested me. How is it that as a folklorist you're interested in this subject?
Well, actually, you know, I'm used to people being sort of intrigued by the idea of a folklorist, I guess, because we're sort of a rare breed, I guess. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we kind of assume in the field of folklore, which is fairly small, but you know, has typically studied things like folk tales and legends, but also you know material culture and things like that, is that anything, any product that's created by humans, could be studied as a folklorist would study it. That is, paying attention to the things that are traditional about it, looking at how the fact that it was associated with people who belong to a group that you might call a folk group sort of influences it. So we always assume that we can study just about anything, actually, mm-hmm. As a folklorist. And there actually are a few other folklorists who are looking at self-help books, so I'm not alone in that.
Well, it's interesting that if you think about it, what you generally think of a folklorist doing, as you say, is studying essentially the stories that people tell themselves and each other. Often what we're talking about is an oral tradition, but more and more, of course, that it becomes something that's written down. And I'm sure even now there are people who study folklore that circulates on the Internet. So,
oh, yes.
So the technology moves forward, but we still are interested in these stories. And that it seems to me that you're looking at stories and you obviously are looking at what they're about, but then there's a lot of reading between the lines. The idea is, okay, here people tell this particular story, and this is the way they tell it, and this is the variations in the story that you find, and this is the way the story gets passed along. But then there is this question, well, what is the story really about? Is it about what it's about, or is it about something else? And you, if you say, well, maybe it's kind of about something else, then you say, well, what can we learn about people essentially by looking at the stories that they tell? And as I sort of see it, that's the question that you ask about this thing that we're talking about here, the self-help book, and that it's something about, well, what do we, if we see that this is something that Americans like to read and have for a long time, then what does it tell us about Americans and what it is that they're interested in, what they worry about, what they're preoccupied with by looking at the stories that they tell one another?
Right. Yes. In a way, it's the same kind of process that would, I guess you'd call literary criticism. You know, you're looking at a piece of literature and bringing to it various tools to help you analyze it. And I think in the case of a folklorist, you know, you're more often going to bring, an awareness of tradition and awareness of things that have been in the culture and then maybe modified to fit this particular artifact, in this case, a book. And the field of folklore and literature, as it's often called, has actually been a part of folklore studies for a long time. People look at, for example, Huckleberry Finn and say, you know, what's the folklore in that? What use does it serve in the book? And even though these books are not ones that we would consider typically, you know, great works of literature, they are written by individuals and you can study them much the same way. It does reflect something about both the individual writing it, but also, and that was part of my argument, that it really does reflect very much about the culture that they're drawing upon and presenting it to, which I think is what you were saying, that mm-hmm. they, you know, the people who read it are sort of participating in a kind of dialogue. I guess if you thought of this as being something that people would present orally rather than in writing, you'd probably be quicker to see it as an example of an engagement, between individuals. But I think it's the same thing with reading. In fact, I'm impressed that people will actually take the time to read a book in our culture, because we, you know, we're so sort of spoiled by television and movies, and people often won't take the time to read a book. But these are, the popularity of these books suggests to me that the people do take that time to become engaged.
Mm-hmm. There, as I said at the beginning, if you go into the bookstore, you can, almost any bookstore, I'm sure that almost any bookstore will have a self-help section, and there will be a lot of books there. And that probably today, if you use that, if you say something is a self-help book, that probably people will know what it is that you mean. However, depending upon how you define what a self-help book is, you might indeed draw in all kinds of things that you might not at first blush identify that way, but then you might say, well, I guess I can see where you might call it that. Is there something that is generally agreed to be, or that a lot of people would say would deserve the status of the first modern self-help book?
Ooh, good question. I guess there'd probably be a lot of people offer different ideas on that. You know, some people might go back to somebody, say, like Emerson, and say that his brand of didactic writing was an example of a self-help book. Myself, I would probably look at somebody like Dale Carnegie, I guess, or you know, something in the early 20th century, rather than going back further than that. Although, you know, I mean, it. I think the sort of hallmark of a self-help book is that it's offering advice about how to live your life, and you know, there's certainly been people doing that since the fables back in ancient Greek times. So it's not just something new, and it's not just something American. But I think the actual phrase self-help book is kind of an interesting one, because probably most academic authors would really not want that associated with a book they had written.
Yeah.
It's you know, people find it a little embarrassing, I guess. And yet, you know, I think a lot of works that are looking either at, you know, what are the sort of contemporary moral perspectives that are current right now, or people that are drawing upon the field of psychology or sociology to sort of enlighten people rather than just to speak to their own discipline, they really are writing for a popular audience, and therefore I think they're writing what I would call a self-help book, even if they didn't initially think of calling it that.
Yeah. You just touch on something right away when you mention Emerson, that I think is an interesting point, because, again, I guess it goes back to this idea of what it is we consider to be self-help, a self-help book, and what that's all about. And that is that, you know, depending upon your age and what kind of books you'd encountered, your touchstone might be, you know, anything from I'm okay, you're okay, to The Power of Positive Thinking, to, you know, whatever. So you could go back to the 60s, you could go to the 50s, you could go to before World War II. But then indeed, there are things that we could point to that arguably could fall into that category that go back even further than that, which does raise this question, well, is there something particularly American about this, and does it have to do with this thing that we like to hold on to? It may well be a myth, but we like to hold on to that we are definitely into, as a nation, we're into self-improvement and into remaking ourselves and into the idea of progress, always ever upward and forward. And that, in a sense, we've always been like that, or at least we'd like to think that we are like that. And that is not just something that's a post-war phenomenon, and not just something that from the 1920s, but in fact, it does indeed go back further in American tradition.
Yeah, in fact, some of the self-help writers themselves do go back and sort of set the stage for what they're doing. And usually they'll go back to, say, someone like Benjamin Franklin and say, okay, here was America's first great self-help writer. And I wouldn't argue against that. I think they're probably right. And they see themselves as simply writing in that same tradition. I wouldn't say that it's uniquely American, because what's interesting is, you know, if you go around the world, you'll see that there are similar sorts of books, and these very same books actually translated into some of the languages of the world. But I think it's particularly characteristic of American society to be wanting to be the best we can be, you know. I mean, it's probably cliche. Most of the worldview that supports that kind of attitude or perspective in our culture. But, I don't think it's it's just exclusively American by any means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do wonder what, obviously, yes, that's right. And you can find books like these all over. And I'm sure that particular books that started out here have been translated into a number of other languages. For example, a book like The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Steve Covey. I expect that that's probably available in a whole lot of languages other than English and is available other places around the world. And other kinds of books like that, I'm sure. How many languages do you think that Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, has been translated into? So, I mean, that, in a sense that you can see these things have real legs, but the fact that they first, I guess I'm going back to the idea that, yes, but first, they were written in English, and they were written by somebody here in the United States.
Right.
This was the ground zero for these books. Now, that doesn't mean that that's the ground zero for self-help, but... And maybe I'm hammering on this point too much, but it does bring me back to this idea. Is there something about the American context that particularly encourages this kind of writing and the interest in this kind of writing?
I think one of the things that I was not able to do for this book, and that I think would probably answer that in a way that isn't just my opinion, which is all I can give you right now, I'm afraid, but it would actually be to do ethnographic work and actually, interview people who've read the books and ask them questions that would I think allow you to answer that with a little more meat to it than what I could answer. I think for my own way of thinking, it's I don't know. I think I'll just pass on until some research is done on it.
That is a perfectly fair response. I would never get down on somebody for answering a question. That's a fine question, but I don't know. All questions cannot be answered. Let me reintroduce our guest, Sandra Dolby. She's professor of folklore and American studies at Indiana University and is interested in the phenomenon of the self-help book and, in fact, read a couple of hundred of them to try to get a better understanding about what they were about, and that the result of some of the things that she learned and thought are in her book, Self-Help Books, Why Americans Keep Reading Them, and it's published by the University of Illinois Press, which takes a look at some rather basic questions about how far back in America we find books like this and why it is they're popular and what they tell us about how Americans think. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Well, I mentioned that there are these three big questions that you were interested in thinking about and writing about. One that we've here talked a little bit about, and that is the idea, is this really new? Mm-hmm. And it seems the answer is not really. It's certainly not something that's just a post-war phenomenon. It goes back some time. Let me ask you about the second question, and we could talk a little bit about that, the second basic question, and that is why it is that these books, we know that they are extremely popular. We know that they're extremely popular now, and that indeed their popularity does go back some ways to some of those older books like Dale Carnegie others that we might name that certainly at least go back before World War II, that people have been buying these books and reading these books for a long time. So the question is, why? Why are these books so popular?
Well, I think I've tried to argue in terms of their serving the purpose of helping people develop a personal philosophy, but I actually would have to say that there's really two reasons. One is that, which is sort of what I wanted to argue in the book, but there is actually the other there's a side, which is simply that they do offer practical advice. And I think there were some books that's sort of the really obvious intent of them. Say a book like this one by Amira Kirschenbaum called Too Good to Leave, Too Bad to Stay. It's a really interesting book because what she does is she just goes through about, 35, 36 different possible kinds of relationships and says, okay, in this case you should stay, in this case you should leave. I mean, it's just sort of very practical, you know, for somebody who's in the throes of trying to decide that question. She's offering pretty straightforward advice, essentially. And or another book like the one by Theodore Rubin on overcoming indecisiveness, which is, you know, another case where somebody's trying to decide anything, really. And he says, okay, here's what you need to do to help yourself make a wise decision. And I think the best books do offer that kind of advice. I think what I was then sort of arguing behind that was that, you know, anytime you are looking for an answer to what to do with some problem in your life, you're also asking, you know, what is the sort of framework, the worldview that will support the particular decision that I make. So in effect, you're, whether you articulate it or not, you're also asking, you know, what do I believe? What's my worldview? What do I think is wise behavior? And so I think anytime anybody's reading a book, whether they're reading it, you know, because they have this problem they desperately need to answer, find an answer to, or whether they're just reading it because they like reading those kinds of books, they're really feeding this this sort of frame of thought that is their own personal philosophy, and sort of building that up. Now, I doubt that most people would say that's why they're reading one of those books, but I was arguing that in fact they are.
Yeah. You at one point in the book you mentioned the fact that you go to the website of Barnes & Noble and started looking at how many titles they list under self-help, and you find more than 17,000. So there's a lot.
There are a lot.
And but, you know, having said that there are a lot of these titles and that that these books have been around for a while, I'm interested in your thoughts about, in a sort of a basic way, what it is these books have to say. Is it seems that the themes, the kinds of things that people are interested in many ways, have not changed. I mean, they're interested in questions of, you know, how can I be more successful? How can I be successful in my career? How can I be successful in my personal relationships? How can I be happy? What is the nature of happiness? What is true fulfillment? How do I find material and spiritual success? You know, all of those those things that seem to be the same questions people have been asking for, well, you know, maybe forever, but at least for a long time. And if you take a look at books, now we have thousands and thousands of these books, some of them that have been in print for a long time, and you look at the advice that's there, I guess one of the things that I wonder is, do you find that there is some sort of consistency as if really it's being recycled almost, that in fact it's in a way there's the same advice has been given by different writers in different books over time? Is there a consistent sort of message being preached?
Yes, there is. I think every writer prides himself or herself on you know, bringing a new voice to the articulation of the basic messages. But I don't think anybody, even among the writers themselves, if pressed, will argue that they're saying anything particularly new. But on the other hand, what's interesting is they almost always say that they are challenging an idea or a behavior or a motif, a belief that's a part of the culture, and that they're offering something in contrast or as an alternative to that. Again, they won't say that nobody else has offered that or anything of the sort, but rather they're making a judgment, essentially. This is bad, this is good, and you should do this that I'm saying is good. It's it's the formula basically is they critique something in the culture and then they offer something that they think would be a better way to either understand things or to behave. And it's, you know, I think the thing that's so compelling about them as books is that as the person's reading it, they probably will agree with the critique that the person, that the writer is making of the culture. You know, Americans are too perfectionist. You know, that we try to be perfectionist, and therefore, in solution to that, you know, they'll offer certain kinds of behavior that will make you be less of a perfectionist and therefore happier. Well, in doing that, you know, they're not really saying anything new. Furthermore, a lot of psychologists would agree probably with that basic premise, but they would also say that it's probably too simplistic, and you know, a lot of other things. And most of the books are pretty simplistic. But the thing that impresses me is that people, in the process of reading them, you know, become engaged, and they do stop and think about it. And they think, oh, well, yes, maybe it's bad to be such a perfectionist that you let that determine everything you do, and so maybe this advice that the person's offering is something I should try. Doesn't mean they'll probably stay with it, and in fact, I would doubt that most people who read a self-help book, you know, sort of the rest of their lives do whatever they were advised to do in that book, but they did stop and think about it. And to me, I think that's actually part of the real value of these books for our culture, is that it makes people stop and think, you know, why are you doing what you do? And they give some thought to it.
Well, we have a couple of callers. We will bring them into the conversation. And again, where I will just a little bit past our midpoint, and maybe I will introduce once again our guest, Sandra Dolby. She's professor of folklore and American studies at Indiana University. And her book is entitled Self-Help Books, Why Americans Keep Reading Them. It is published by the University of Illinois Press, and it is the product of her spending some time reading a couple of hundred self-help books, and finds that they may indeed reflect a well-established American love for self-education and pragmatic problem-solving. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here to start out with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I've read a lot of self-help books, and I love self-help books. I'm going to tell you a little bit about me. I'm 70 years old almost, and I have MS. The whole concept of self and help, I think, is very important. Does that mean, I'm resorting back to Emerson's quote, the quote he said was, trust thyself, every heart beats to that iron string. Does that mean that we don't trust ourselves? That's a question for you, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, what do you think?
Okay. Does that mean that we don't trust ourselves? Well, I think a lot of the writers suggest that, in fact, people don't trust themselves, and that, you know, that's why they're they're being reminded that they should, I guess, by someone like Emerson or even more recent writers. I think a lot of the writers are trying to create more confidence. In fact, one of the books, the title of the book is, you know, the Confidence Course. It's by a man named Anderson, I think. And the real aim he had in the book was simply to get people to be more confident in what they do, so that's why it was called that, and I think that was his assumption that people are lacking in sort of self-confidence.
I think it's interesting in the sense that as you mentioned, we were talking about the appeal of self-help books, and that in some respects the appeal is that people have a particular, perhaps a very specific kind of problem, and they're interested in some advice on some suggestions about how to solve that particular problem. And yet at the same time, though, it seems that within these kind of books, there's a fairly prominent stream that essentially says, if you sit down and think about it, probably you have the solution to your problem already. And that it's that you don't need to have somebody else tell you what it is, that, you know, given some reflection and maybe a little bit of assistance, you can figure it out yourself. And I don't know if those two things are necessarily in tension. That is, the idea that that you have the key to solving your own problems, as opposed to this book that says, I'm going to give you the 27 things that you can do to solve your problems.
That's well put. I think most writers would probably agree with you, but they probably wouldn't say it because then they wouldn't sell their books. But yeah, I think most of them would probably say that what they're really helping their reader do is unlearn the bad. I don't know whether bad is the right word, but the erroneous thoughts that are in their heads. And then to open it up to either accept what they're suggesting or just take the time to really think what you really do believe instead of a sort of acting out of what I guess you would call a kind of cultural determinism, which is really what I think they're mostly arguing against, is that you need to be aware, not just, act from your culture, which, and again, back to your very first question you posed to me about being a folklorist, I think that's one of the things that's probably surprising when people consider the field of folklore, since we study things that are sort of maintained by the culture, that one of the things we do as folklorists is actually encourage people to question their own culture, to think about it. Not just accept it because it was part of what you grew up in or grew into.
Well, let's talk with someone else. This is also a caller in Champaign, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I just been listening in the car, and a couple of thoughts crossed my mind. One is I would suspect, but I, of course, don't know either, that part of our culture's fascination with these comes out of a couple things. One, our firm belief that people are successful because of something they do or don't do as individuals. And the other thing that as individuals we have a right to, to happiness and pursue happiness. And if we're unhappy, then we're doing something wrong, and we have to, we have to figure out some way of making ourselves happy. And those things, I think, really are strong within our culture. I was thinking myself of, the fact that I really don't tend to read these kinds of books unless I have a particular thing I'm interested in. I haven't really read them as a group, unless I would have some kind of problem so that I was looking for nutrition or I was looking for information. But I remember vividly back in the 60s reading the books that, the self-help books like Our Bodies, Ourselves and Changing Bodies, Changing Lives and, Joy of Sex and those kinds of things, which were basically information kinds of things. The other thing that has crossed my mind several times now that I'm, in my 50s, that very seldom do we get a chance to engage in questions of, what we really believe. And I occasionally help with high school students, and they're writing these essays on topics and examining what they're, the whole makeup and stuff, and I think to myself, geez, I'd like to write that now as a 50-something person in that perspective. I wonder if there is a big difference between people who are in the academic world and how much they read self-help books and other people, or whether or not, they fulfill the same, these questions in some other aspect of their life, where, you know, through their conversations as part of their work. And those are my questions, kind of, and comments.
Okay. Well, Professor Dolby, you want to reflect on that?
There were a lot of questions in there. One of the things I guess I would say is that in terms of, you know, whether it's an academic individual that's going to, you know, look at self-help books, a lot of the people who write the self-help books actually are people, for example, with PhDs and who write for their disciplines, particularly psychology, it seems like. But often they regard them as a different kind of writing entirely, and I think in that respect they see it as almost like public intellectual engagement, in the way that the old Chautauquas used to be. You know, where people are just addressing kind of moral and civic questions in a public context. And in this case, they're in books where you, of course, read them individually. But interestingly, a lot of people will take some of these books, like The Road Less Traveled. They'll take, by Peck, they'll take that book and they'll meet in a group and talk about it collectively. So I think the idea of it still, of it serving that purpose, is one of the things that could explain some of the appeal of these kinds of books. It is interesting that the demographics of the people who read these books, they, you know, we haven't studied that as much as we should yet, but in general, yeah, it's adults rather than, well, there's some that are that are geared to teenagers. Typically, there are more women than men, but not necessarily, especially if you include books that have to do with business, for example. There are a lot of men who read those. But I think the assumption often is that the typical reader is female. But one of the great critiques of the self-help books used as an example, a man who had invested some $6,000 in buying a lot of books. So it's, you know, it's a mixed bag, I'd say. And I'm sure I didn't answer some of the other questions. Sorry.
What is the caller still there? Would you like to follow up at all? I guess not. Well, let me then follow up, because I on at least one of the points, because I think that it's that it caught my attention, and that is I think that there are a lot of people who would argue that here in the United States, as we think about various social problems, sometimes public health problems, that we're hampered in developing appropriate solutions for them because we cannot let go of the idea of personal responsibility. That is, that somehow there is entirely too much blaming of the victim, that somehow we think, well, if somebody's having a problem, that it's probably their fault. It is indeed because of something that either they have done or failed to do. And whether you see that, or is that something that underlies the great popularity and the just how many of these books there are, that does somehow reflect our feeling that if something's wrong, it's probably because something that you've done, and then you yourself can do something about it as long as you just take the right action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you've articulated that very, very interestingly, because you included both sides of it. One is that Americans feel generally self-responsible, yes, and I think that's actually a kind of assumption that's made throughout most of the books. But whether that's sort of a way of explaining how Americans would feel that we've sort of got to blame ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that many of the writers would feel comfortable saying that they were saying that. They may be saying that, but they don't intend to, I don't think. I think most of them feel that what they're really advocating is that you recognize that you have decisions to make, and that there are things that can help you make a wise decision or the wisest decision you can. But one of the things that's sort of interesting, for example, in that book called Overcoming Indecisiveness, one of the things he says, and I hear this echoed in a lot of the writings, is it doesn't really matter which way the decision goes. It's what you do after you've made the decision that matters. And I think most of the writers are probably really addressing that. That is, it's what you bring to your own decision that really is the important sort of reflection of both your own abilities, but also your worldview and your thought. I mean, they're not going to say that, you know, making a nasty decision like, you know, murder or something like that is a good thing ever. But instead, in terms of the kinds of things where it seems like one decision could be as good as the other, they're not saying that you have to make this one decision, that that's the only way it could go. In fact, they're arguing against that, I would say.
Just quickly, too, to pick up on another point that Carl made, and I wonder whether you think that it is true that, again, the popularity of these books, the fact that there are so many, does say that we take that phrase about the pursuit of happiness very seriously, and that we do in some sense feel entitled to happiness. And also this may reflect kind of pragmatic approach to that if we're not happy, that there's a way to do it, that there's a very particular and very pragmatic way to do it, and it's something that can indeed be reduced to things like, you know, a set of 5 rules or 10 rules or founding principles, you know, or whatever, and say, well, if you just do these 5 things, then, you know, you'll get to where you want to go. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think probably there is that assumption behind most of the books that it is our sort of right to pursue happiness and that we have a right to expect to be able to achieve it. Probably one of the most interesting books, and actually I know you interviewed Peter Kramer a week or two ago, who has written a book called Against Depression.
Yes.
And he had actually written a book earlier than that called Should You Leave, which I thought was just a wonderful, wonderful book. But this newest one that he's written called Against Depression, which again, you know, people would say, well, is that a self-help book? But I think in many ways it is, because what he's arguing in that book is that, you know, this whole notion of depression as something that, you know, is maybe even to be glorified or something, is not true. It should be something that you should try to find a cure for, and that in fact you can. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think he's saying much as you do were saying about any other kind of problem. He would see depression as a problem that needs to be solved, and in this case, a medical problem, or a psychological problem. But yes, indeed, there is a solution. I think the interesting thing is that, you know, each writer probably has to believe in the solution they're offering enough to be able to write the book, or they wouldn't do it, you know. But on the other hand, they probably wouldn't argue that that's the only solution.
Well, let's take, we have another caller. Let's talk with them. And this is someone in Urbana in line 1. Hello.
I've only been able to focus in bits and snatches on what you're saying, but distillation of some of what you've been saying, what some of these books have to say. I just saw at a website for they'll make vinyl letters for you for a quote and do it in the type of style that you want, and then you put it on your wall. And one pair of writers, their self-help mantra on their wall in their office where their work is something to the effect of, one, what is standing in your, what do you want? What is in your way, and what are you doing about it? And they see this every day. I thought, that sounds like, you know, a distillation of all this stuff. But I, you know, I think that these self-help books form a wider community and extend our experience beyond our community in terms of coming up with ideas of how to deal with stuff, and you pick and choose based on what makes sense to you in your situation. Thanks a bunch. Enjoy listening to you.
All right. Thank you. Well, and I also want to make sure that people who are listening know that you, Professor Dolby, this is not necessarily intended to be some sort of negative critique of self-help books. You're not saying that they're no good, that people shouldn't read them, that they're, you know, that anybody who does is making a mistake. That's not it at all. You're just interested in the content, what's in the books, and what it tells us about what people think is important.
That's right. And in fact, to be honest, I rather enjoy reading them. And I had to, if I read the, actually I've read, oh, I would say more than 300 of these books, and you know they vary in quality. But to me, it's sort of like you know there are some of them that are enjoyable, and perhaps some that aren't as much enjoyable. They remind me very much of you know like a sermons or homilies that you know that have to do with how to live life well or whatever. There, some people enjoy them, and some people just want the music or whatever. You know, so it's sort of, you know, your own taste, I suppose, that decides whether this is what appeals to you or not. But I think they're a very worthwhile phenomenon to take a look at, both for academic reasons, but also personal reasons. I've found them useful.
Well, let's going back to where we started when I was asking you about being a folklorist and the fact that would mean you'd approach the subject from a particular point of view, and the fact that one of the basic questions that you set out to try to think about and write about was, and as you write about it here in the book, what do these books tell us about the popular wisdom of mainstream Americans? After having now read several hundred of these books and thought about them, is it possible to distill from them some kind of basic American folk wisdom that seems to be enduring and seems to be sort of common, widespread that you see over and over again?
Well, it's interesting. I think, for example, the last caller who outlined the three, you know, questions to ask, including, you know, what are you doing and why are you doing it, or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the books simply are asking you to stop and think, you know, what are you doing? But I think, aside from that, probably advocating that people be honest. I read in just one book after another that one of the things that is a real problem for most people is simply being honest. And so, you know, George Washington was right. You know, you need to tell the truth, but to yourself and to other people as well. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, one of the main problems was dishonesty. And then the other, interestingly, is, and it sounds so mushy, I suppose, but that most of them are advocating that you need to love yourself, love other people, love the world, love the planet. And so I think, you know, it is a kind of sort of almost, I wouldn't hesitate to say moral stance so much as, you know, what is seen as most valuable. And in this case, most of them would argue that having the capacity to love yourself and to love people and then act on that is probably what is most American. And I think it bothers people when they see that we aren't, as we currently aren't, always acting on that as a reason for what we're doing. Hmm. And so I think that's part of the popularity, is people see that as something that they feel has an echo in what they own, their own sort of philosophy is.
Just, I'm prompted, we really don't have the time for you to answer this question very well. But I guess I'm wondering how much this connects to people's religious beliefs, and how much that, particularly, I guess, the Judeo-Christian sort of way of thinking enters into this. So I'm sure that if you go back and look at a lot of self-help writers and what they've written, that it's very secular. And yet, at the same, and if you look at what the values are, you'd say, well, those are the value, you know, the values that religions hold on to too. I mean, does that help shape this tradition at all?
Yes, it does. And what's interesting is that some of the writers, in fact, are very blunt about their own religious backgrounds. But I think the thing that's interesting to me is that it's like so many other religious documents, I guess. They are a secular kind of morality that's popular, just the way it was with, I guess, the Chautauquas or things like that.
Mm. Well, I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop because we've used our time, but I will again suggest that people can look at the book, Self-Help Books, Why Americans Keep Reading Them, if they'd like to think more about this and read more about the subject. Our guest is Sandra Dolby. She's professor of folklore and American studies at Indiana University. The book is published by the University of Illinois Press. And Professor Dolby, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Programs here on AM 580 made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Don't miss your opportunity to win one of a dozen major prizes in the WILL sweepstakes, including the $2,000 Garden Grand Prize from Country Arbor's Nursery or a Dell computer, a home theater audio system from Champaign Audio, a Lustra Luminette window treatments by Hunter Douglas from The Blind Man in Champaign, or a $1,000 gift certificate from Corley Photography. But you can't win if you don't enter, and entries must be postmarked by September 6th. To request an entry form, call us at 217-333-1070. And that is it for us here on Focus 580, but there's much more in the way of news and features and other things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with Richard Lavoie. He has 30 years of experience in the field of special education. We'll talk with him this afternoon about helping children with learning disabilities find social success. Children need to be wanted, and some kids have no problem. They win acceptance easily. For others, it's not so easy. That's what we'll talk about this afternoon with Richard Lavoie. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. On the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat trading at 312, that down 2. December 327, down 1.5. September corn 205 and 3/4, down 3. December 219 and 1/4, down 3. March 228 and 3/4, down 3.25. May 234 and 3/4, down 3.5. September soybeans 587, that down 15.5. November 596.5, down 16.25. January 604, down 15.75. September soybean meal 182.80, down 550. September oil 2212, down 38.